Clarence Stone has spent decades examining local governments, race and class, inequality, and education reform. He's been called a leading theorist in urban politics, his research foundational.
This is Clarence Stone. I am a research professor at George Washington University in the fields of public policy and political science. For many years, I was a professor of government at the University of Maryland, and my specialty has been urban policy and local government.
To understand what many urban school districts are facing today, Professor Stone starts with some history.
I myself, you know, grew up in the South, and I can remember a time when we lived in this little town that had a separate school system, black and white, and the black school was literally a one-room schoolhouse. It was a big room, but you can imagine from that that the scope of the education provided was an absolute minimal education.
Stone points to other factors, including the Great Migration, when millions of Southern black families moved north, and the deindustrialization of urban cities, which peaked in the 1970s.
So here we had this unfortunate perfect storm, or, you know, worst possible combination. The black population accumulates in cities, in urban areas, and that reaches a peak at the very point when blue-collar jobs begin to disappear. And those jobs that you could go into with less education are less and less available. One of the additional complications, of course, is that the Great Migration was not a matter of a cross-section of the population migrating. It was the population that was concentrated in southern agriculture. So what you had was an economy and a society that was dependent on low-wage workers. Low-wage workers also meant that the people who were benefiting the most from that low-wage work were people who did not want to invest very much in education, because if you educate workers, then they don't want to be low-wage workers anymore.
Stone says for those working on education reform today, especially in high-poverty districts, knowing history is crucial.
The real core of the education crisis is, how do we play catch-up for a set of circumstances that was generations in building and was geographically complicated in how it took its final shape? So that's really what is the sort of core of the concern about reforming education.
One of Clarence Stone's books is Building Civic Capacity, The Politics of Reforming Urban Schools. Stone and his co-authors argue that labeling education reform a priority isn't enough. Neither are top-down mandates, programmatic reform, or institutional approaches.
School reform, that is, changing the performance of the education system, is a big and complicated problem. So do not expect for that to be something that can be taken care of in a couple of years. So that's just kind of upfront. People should be confronted with the reality. The second thing I would say is that people should not think about school reform as something separate from what's going on in the city, what's going on in the community. Because if you think back to things like cultural capital, for example, are the kinds of role models that people might be exposed to, then you have to realize that the performance of a school is very much determined by the community context in which it operates, the resources that that community can bring to bear.
Systemic change, says Stone, takes time. It starts with civic mobilization of a broad range of stakeholders. That process leads to building civic capacity, or the ability of diverse community members to come together, identify a problem, and collaborate on solutions.
The challenge then is how to get people involved so that they don't burn out. And this is both, you know, the teachers and the volunteers and for the parents not to feel, you know, put off by the circumstances they face. So educated middle class people need to understand, for example, that a parent who is not well educated can easily feel inferior because they don't have these accomplishments that have come to be valued in the modern world to a degree that they were not like, you know, when they were kids themselves. So there's a kind of adjustment to social and cultural change that is going to make some people feel left out. Some people feel that they're not valued. So these are, you know, things that take time. What I would emphasize is that when people sign on to do school reform, that they understand that there are many parts to it. And if they can be matched up with the part where they can begin to feel some success, that they are making some contribution, and that the contribution they make is appreciated, then you're beginning to create the kind of mix of things that will enable them to stick with it and to begin to appreciate. You know, one of the things we say about school reform is that it's not a sprint, it's a marathon. And so a marathon takes more than a couple of years.
What facilitates civic capacity? And do you have examples where this is playing out successfully?
Well, that's a really challenging question. And so
Stone says, frankly, it's easier to find examples when good intentions fizzle out. But he was encouraged by what happened in El Paso in the early 1990s. Good-paying factory jobs were disappearing in the Texas border town. Community leaders connected the economic realities to an urgent need to address education.
Now, the interesting thing is that the first response to that sense of urgency came actually from a community organization that was based primarily in the Mexican-American community, because with the changing economy, they were most threatened.
Stone says the group knew about an education compact in Boston and started asking if that could work in El Paso. The new president of the University of Texas, El Paso, saw that they could play an important role. She brought in a staff member to enlist other community stakeholders. What formed was the El Paso Collaborative for Academic Excellence. Partners included the three school districts, the university, the community college, two chambers of commerce, parents, teachers, and civic and religious leaders.
You know, you build civic capacity, I think, by starting with some sense that there is a community problem that has urgency to it, and we need to muster the effort to respond to it.
Stone says there was a lot of smart thinking about how to build the collaborative. They started with area-wide workshops on how to improve education. Superintendents, teachers, principals, and assistant principals participated. The first question to tackle was how to involve parents.
And what they discovered was the teachers and principals didn't really sort of gravitate naturally to that question. And so they had to be sort of redirected to the question.
The small things made a big difference. The workshop was 2 days long, so they wrote a grant to pay for meals.
Anybody who's organized groups knows that it's always helpful if you serve a meal, or in this case, over 2 days, meals as part of it.
Clarence Stone says this example teaches an important lesson. It's not enough to start with a sense of urgency.
You have to work on building a feeling of momentum that we are going somewhere. We're going to accomplish this.
And even that small grant to pay for meals feeds that feeling of momentum.
It's important to be able to bring together a succession of steps that convey some sense of, yes, we are doing this. We are making progress. We are putting ourselves in the position of responding to this problem.
In addition to this macro-level coalition building, Stone says participants need to think about the micro-strategy, building relationships and trust.
How do we weave people together so that within the sort of formal boundaries, if you will, of the large coalition, there are all of these personal connections that can help get through some of the rough spots and can expand the base of understanding.
What's the role of the superintendent in all of this, in school reform, in building civic capacity?
Well, the superintendent, as the head of the key institution, obviously has the role that must work. And it has to work in a way in which she or he is open to bringing other people in. So it needs to be someone who is not particularly anxious about how do I protect my turf, but who sees herself or himself as needing this larger coalition. So, you know, to go back to that term about who has convening power, the superintendent is not the only one, but the superintendent has absolutely to be a key person in exercising this convening power. The second thing I would say is that when people look at what happens in individual schools, the principal is the key figure at the school level. So as the superintendent, you know, thinks about the school system overall, it seems to me that the recruitment, the training, further professional development, et cetera, for principals has to be a key factor. And then in turn, you know, those principals need to be part of a broader strategy. So that's where the superintendent can sort of play an additional role of thinking about what are all of the different elements that need to come together. So there's the professional capacity of the educators themselves. There is the question of the curriculum and is it aligned and so on. But the emphasis, if you're thinking about educating the whole person and drawing the whole community and especially the school and the community together, the superintendent has got to be a key figure in identifying those parts of the community that can be drawn in. So if one of the major needs is we need to expand our revenue base, then how can the superintendent engage the business community, the business sector, in thinking about expanding the financial support for the school system? Now, you know, business people have a tendency to worry, first of all, about, well, what's the tax bill going to be? But I think it's important to think long term about these things. And so that, so the superintendent sort of has to be a kind of wizard of, you know, how can we do many things? How do we deal with these immediate problems? How do I recruit these principals? But also, it's got to be thinking about how can I educate the community to think long term? So we should think about money spent on education, not as, oh, you know, here comes another, you know, demand on tax revenue, but to think instead about how do we invest in this community for its long-term well-being.
Citing an analogy used by other researchers, Stone says school reform is like baking a cake.
So what does that mean? It means that you've got to have all of the ingredients brought together in such a way that they complement one another. So you can't have a successful cake if some key ingredients are missing. And so the superintendent has to be the one that thinks overall about, do I have all of the ingredients there? And for those communities of special need, you know, where the poverty level is high, where homelessness may be a problem, where there may be problems of child abuse. We don't sort of naturally gravitate to thinking about those things, but they are part of the education challenge. And so this particular scholar talks about those communities that are truly disadvantaged. That's the phrase that, so they're the ones that have the high poverty rate, the high level of, kids who are in foster care and so on. And as much as, you know, sort of educated middle class people might not be mindful of the level of that need, it's there. And that's where the education challenge is most substantial. So, and that's where things like the community school that maybe has a health clinic, that has a good working relationship with social services and mental health professionals. And, you know, just a range of things to sort of add to the resources that the schools can draw on. That's absolutely essential. And so particularly for those, communities and neighborhoods that are truly disadvantaged, as he says, the cake just isn't gonna make it if you don't have a strategy and a program for addressing those sort of special social needs.
I have a question from a listener. What advice do you have for successfully building civic capacity at the grassroots level, for example, between teachers and parents?
Well, El Paso is an example of that, because part of the program of the collaborative was to work specifically on how to be more effective in incorporating and engaging parents and community people in the work. And so what they did was to create and run each year a sort of special, if you will, school for parents. And I think they met maybe weekly, maybe biweekly, certainly at least once a month. And so education professionals would be part of it, but they would pick maybe 25 or 30 or so parents, you know, working with the schools to get the parents enlisted to come and take part in these classes about engagement. Now, of course, because school professionals were also part of the class, you were there in the first place building a connection between, you know, parents and the school system. But they would go through various topics, and at the end of the year, then they would get together and have sort of like a graduation celebration, so that they could look back over the things that they had accomplished. And then that would be the foundation for going into a second year with a new round of whatever, 25 or 30 parents. So they weren't doing this en masse to try to, you know, do everything at once, but to do it in sort of incremental steps. But then as they had a second class and a third class, then they would have an alumni getting together at the end of the school year so that those who had been in one class could connect with those who had been in another class. And so you were building, you know, the relationships across classes, but also across the parent, you know, school divide. Now, the other part of this strategy overall was to, you know, work on recruiting teachers who were comfortable with working with parents. And in effect, to run professional development classes for the teachers so that they could begin to develop their own skills and facilities in working with parents. Now, an interesting thing is that one of the most effective teachers in doing this was someone who was a Marine veteran who was teaching kindergarten. And he was so effective and skillful in doing this that the school system put him in charge of running special classes for other teachers about how to work with parents. And so, you know, kind of, again, multiple things, you know, make something easier to be accomplished than if you think of just like, well, we're going to do this single, you know, strategy. So that cake making is sort of in the background. You know, what are all of the ingredients that we can put together that will, you know, enable us to bake a really good cake?
Clarence Stone is a research professor at George Washington University in the fields of public policy and political science. He's the co-author of Building Civic Capacity, The Politics of Reforming Urban Schools, and the editor of Changing Urban Education. For Learning Curve, I'm Catherine Comp, WCVE News.